Hey, everybody. I'm really glad to have Dan Gallagher of All Things Financial on. He had a couple of viral clips that went really blew up substantially in and around the period of the yen trade unwinding, I suppose, partially. We're not believers that the fullness of that has been done, but he had a lot of very interesting takes, and I was delighted to get him on. So first of all, Dan, welcome, and thanks for agreeing to give us some of your time.
Thank you for having me, Francis. I appreciate it.
No, it's an absolute pleasure. And thank you for your thoughts. I suppose before I get into some of my questions, let's take you a little bit on your background and then also your take on that yen, the summary that you would give people who are wondering, is it over? How much more? A little bit of the specifics, because as you mentioned, a lot of people became overnight internet experts on that topic. What's your take, first of all?
Are you referring to the yen carry trade or to the liquidity?
The yen carry trade. Yes, indeed.
Okay. Well, the yen carry trade has been going on now for, I think, 23 and a half years. So I think people need to realize that. So no one knows the size of the trade. It's estimated between $4 and $20 trillion. I always say four to be safe, but it could be as big as 20. Now, every market crash that we've had in the past, we've had some kind of negative liquidity event. And I have a video that goes over the negative liquidity events that have happened in the past. So the question that I come to now is the yen carry trade, is it possibly going to be our negative liquidity event? So you have to take it into context. One, we have thrown $6 trillion onto the Fed balance sheet. We took off $2 trillion, but we have huge bills out there, the CHIPS Act, the Infrastructure Act, plus all the COVID stuff we threw into the economy. So the liquidity in the market is unprecedented, historical in every sense of the matter. Okay? So if we're going to have a negative liquidity event that actually makes the markets go down, it's going to have to be huge. It can't be anything that we normally have experienced in the past, because we've never had remotely this much liquidity in the market. So when you look around, you say, well, is the yen trade big enough to cause an issue? And I think we saw a shot across the bow where, yeah, it was very possible that it's big enough that it could hurt us, okay? And now, by the way, the BOJ came out, not yesterday, I think the day before, and said that they believe that the yen carry trade is mostly over. You saw JP Morgan announce that they thought it was 75% done. Listen, I am not saying I have any inside information on this thing, but I find it hard to believe that 23 years plus 7.5 years, they had negative rates. So that means everybody, and by the way, so are the biggest carry trade, whatever you want to say, people on it, are the Japanese people themselves. They go buy their JGB, the money, then go over to America or wherever else they want to go and buy the bonds or the stocks there. So I guess they're conditioned, just like all the institutions in the world are conditioned. I believe that the oil trade broke because the CTAs were using the yen carry trade as their basis. And so when they were forced to liquidate their oil, and you could see that whole week, it was liquidation. I mean, anybody's been in the market for a while, you could see there was major liquidation. Also, it was very interesting, the physical contracts of oil that week actually went up slightly. But the financial contracts on oil went from 47,000 down to negative 12,000. So that tells you that it was the financial people getting out of oil so that they could do something with the money. We're assuming, since the yen went to a high of 140.40, that it was because they were buying the yen. And so, hence, here we are.
Just to come in on a question there. There was a yen carry trade unwind, which means somebody was borrowing cheap and chasing risk somewhere else outside of Japan. In your thinking, because of the break in the oil, you feel some of that hot money that was chasing speculation could have actually been in some form long on the oil markets. Is that correct?
Right.
I
would say, you know, in my opinion, there's no doubt on that one. Okay. Because you have to understand something. Institutions have at least hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of positions. Okay. And maybe millions when you count CUSIPs and everything else. Okay. So if you sit there and say, oh, geez, look, Japan's their inflation rate's up. Their economy looks like it's actually going to start growing for the first time in 23 years. Maybe the yen is now going to move up and they're going to have to raise their interest rate. So then you sit there and you say, okay, risk on, risk off. So if I'm going to go risk off and you're an institution, a major institution, I'll tell you for a fact, the first thing they do, they go, where are our biggest bids? Where's our deepest market that we can hit? And hit it hard, because we're not here saying, oh, do I think ARM is a better investment or NVIDIA is a better investment? No, we're saying risk off. So they go to their deepest markets. And that week, we saw what happened. All our high-tech stocks, the big ones, NVIDIA and everything got killed, right? Down about 30%. And then the oil trade. Think about it. The U.S. stock market is the deepest stock market. And the oil market is the deepest commodity.
Commodity, yes, absolutely. But isn't there an element? Because part of the whole pincer movement was, A, Japan increasing rates. Even though it was a small amount, it's also the first movement in potentially a new trend, which could be C, future. So people start pricing out not just that increase, but the possibility of others. And then at the same time, we had a decreasing rates narrative on the U.S. and then an unemployment number that got restated. There was about 818,000 jobs that they just said, look, these were assumed in, they never happened. They reverted that, which is an economy weakness indicator. And the typical consumption tax on an economy is oil, because it's Amazon, you buy, you get delivered and all of that. So in my mind, that the oil going down may have been as you suggested, but there's also the obvious thing. The U.S. is a weaker economy than they've been letting on, because they weren't in a recession when they met the criteria of a recession because of a labor number. And now that labor number, that one reason turned out to be a lie on a lagging indicator that they revised non-farm payrolls 11 times out of 13 and then took a million out the number, the better part of a number. In other words, weak economy. And then in some senses, the depth of the oil market that you make very well. It's also the proxy for economic strength, isn't it? Purchasing, travel, flying, it's the biggest, the Rockefeller tax for consumers in essence. So I kind of framed it as it's also logically the thing that should go down, because we're seeing a commodity cocoa going back up. And today we're seeing gold going up. It's that consumer element. We've kind of got this commodity split where you've got the monetary commodities and softs as well, which is on dollar weakness, and then you've got the consumer commodity of oil. Have I got it wrong, or would you concur?
I have to say that's one of the narratives out there. I don't necessarily buy it at all.
Okay.
I don't think that will slow down. I mean,
with just the depth of the liquidity in your mind, that's an oil market.
Well, I would say the markets are a function of liquidity, period. Mm. Okay. So interest rates don't matter. I bought my first apartment at 11.25% mortgage. Okay. So that interest rates affects as individual stock for some reason or other, but the markets are a function of liquidity. And when you look at that narrative, I mean, we were down into the threes on unemployment. For 125 years, the average unemployment rate in this country is 5.8%. We're at 4.2. The Fed thinks we're going to go to 4.25 by the end of the year. And if you read Bowman's remarks to the Kentucky Bankers Association, she was the Fed governor who disagreed with the half-point cut. She goes through point by point by point by point, 4 points, on why she thinks that they were wrong and that she was right, even though she supports them and so forth and so on. But my guess is Bowman's going to be our next Fed governor.
Okay, that's an interesting prediction. That's I'll watch out for that one. But I also say stats, lies, damn lies, and statistics, because that's on a terrible labor participation rate. So if you're only choosing a small subset of people to measure that stat, I mean, in terms of participation rate, I think in terms of males, we're not much better than the 30s in terms of participation.
When, employment is a difficult thing for all the governments nowadays. I mean, the question is, are you employed? What kind of employer are you? What kind of employment do you have? How do you look at yourself? What do we do with an Instagram person? The Fed Reserve has studies out there telling you the difficulty they have in understanding the new employment markets, which are totally different. Is work from home? Do you need to have the, company paying you? What is the norm now for people working? And they have stated that they have trouble. When are you unemployed? I mean, the big thing in California with the Uber drivers is if they get laid off, can they collect unemployment? And the answer is no. All right. So are they employees? Are they not employees? How do you do that? That's all my point is. So I would say, don't worry so much about if you believe that the government's lying to you. I think that's a cop out. The thing is to watch the numbers and watch them with your eyes open and not with, as I call, prejudice, right? We're all prejudiced. The biggest thing an investor needs to do is to control your prejudice. If you can do that, then you can at least take a step back and look at the world in a more neutral light. So
I am probably.
go ahead. I'm just going to say the narrative out there that we're collapsing, I just find it's not in the numbers anywhere. And we assume, and then oil is going to be interesting because let's be honest, 50% of all oil is used for cars. And cars right now, they're great move into EVs. It's never going to stop. Okay. And so, there is a peak oil out there as we already had it already. What's the story? I think we actually hit it a few years ago. And, so I look at oil as something that I look at it more under the terms of deglobalization. I don't think that the people have thought through what we actually mean by deglobalization. And we've kind of muddied the waters because we moved into this thought process of the supply chain, and the supply chain breaking down was inflationary. And so I look at deglobalization on a much bigger scale, and that transition from a globalized world to a whatever we're going to go, semi-deglobalization, regionalization, whatever you want to call it, that transition never in history has ever been easy. So I'm not anticipating that this one will be easy. Where we're going to go with this, I don't know. But the three biggest things in globalization, there's thousands of things, but the three biggest: food, energy, and currency. And the currencies are all over the place, right? Because the globalization is breaking down, okay? So you're seeing in the globalization on the currencies. And the discussion on the currencies is everywhere, right? Is it going to be the yuan? Are we going to adopt the BRICS? Are we going to go to crypto? Is we're going to go to gold-backed standard and everything? The only thing I'll say on that is China and Russia desperately went off the SWIFT system, which allows us to sanction them and their banks. And I would say they're highly capable countries when it comes to software and hackers and so forth. I'd say they're very, very good. They're highly motivated. They're trillion-dollar economies. And 2 weeks ago, I had everything on the plate. They could have gone crypto. They could have gone gold. They could have gone with the yuan. They could have gone with the BRICS. But what did they decide to do? They decided to go with Russia's Kurya, which is an exchange application so they can exchange goods. So they didn't pick crypto. They could have. They didn't even try. They could have gone with the BRICS. That's a joke. They couldn't go with the euro. So they went with, they're going to barter. Okay. So I don't know where everyone gets, you know, on crypto, I don't understand. Is it a security or is it a currency? If it's a currency, no one uses it. If it's a security, which crypto denies to the high heaven, what is it? And why are you buying it? What's it going to do?
Yeah.
I don't know. All right. And believe me, I have a lot of young clients and they are crypto fanboys. There's no doubt about it. I get it. I hear it all day.
Mm-hmm. I don't see
why a country doesn't, if Russia and China didn't choose crypto now, of all the times in history, they went with bartering, which goes back 5,000 years. Think about it. Why?
Well, it's probably that the currency can stand to be dominated. That's why it's not the yuan or the ruble, because it would be too much like replacing one nation state hegemony with one that's not even yet ready to be that.
Well, it can never be the yuan. The reason being...
No, I don't think it can either.
Well, there's only 1.4% of the yuan outside the country, okay?
Yeah.
So then the other thing is, when you think about it, on a base level, okay? If you're going to be the, forget America, forget all the country, forget we're on Earth. If you said that we're going to have a country be the reserve currency, the number one characteristic of that country, it must be a great importer, not exporter. Because as it imports, it then exports the currency to the world. So if you're a great exporter like China, how could they ever become the world's reserve currency? It's logistically impossible.
Yeah. Well, what one can say that America used to do much more manufacturing when it originally got the dollar than it does today. So it became a bigger exporter of dollars over time. But yeah, you're right. I don't even think it's a question of a single nation state. It seems to me it could probably be a basket. It could also be resource-based. And I wonder if the CBDCs are not ready yet. Bartering is very neutral. It's not non-offensive, and it allows custom contracts, doesn't it? You know, I'll give you X for that amount of corn and fuel.
Let me ask you a question. Have you ever read an article, seen anybody speak on television, the internet, or anywhere, anywhere, at any time in the last 30 years, and say the euro can be the world's currency? Why?
Because it's too flawed.
It's same size as the US dollar.
Yeah. But they haven't proliferated outside of Europe.
Because it's a currency agreement. All the governments are still separate. That's why the BRICS will never be the currency, because they don't have taxing power. They don't have legal power. Look at the euro. Where did every company in the world go to open their company to deal business in the euro? They went to England.
They
went there for the legal, because the legal, they like the legal structure. Okay. So that's why. So you can't, when you look at these things and you say, what is going on? How can we do this? Right. You can't have the BRICS. You can't have the euro. You need a single taxing authority that can sign all the contracts. And that leaves us right now with America. And by the way, last year, the dollar had the highest percent of world trade in its history. So for the dollar dying, the numbers are saying it's not.
Yeah, is that in real terms, inflation adjusted?
Highest ever was last year. So where is it going? And by the way, if we're not going to deglobalize, we might as well have this discussion. No one discussing this. So let's say we deglobalize. Let's say things go crazy, right? And now we're there. And now, let me ask you a question. In the old world, which I think we're in a new world, so I think the old world started in July of 1946 with the Bretton Woods agreements naming the dollar as the as the key the world currency. And it went till 2019 when the old world ended. Okay? Now we're in the transition period. But let's say the transition period goes. We're 5 years, 10 years down the road. Okay? Imagine all the trouble you want. Throw it all in there and everything. And now you're going to reevaluate countries on a different level. In the old world, who would you say was the worst country for the globalization era? The worst. I'm talking about financially. Who would you say was the worst country?
Worst by what measure?
I'm just saying in the old world, we looked around and said, wow, these guys are a bunch of bums. I would say Argentina was number one because they went bankrupt.
Africa, Central Africa, yeah.
Right? 9 times they went bankrupt. Okay?
Yeah.
So, one of the great countries that actually made out very well during that era was China. Okay? Yeah. So, and then you have to say to yourself, what happened that allowed these countries to rise up? And what happened was the American empire, which it was, but it was a different, we always said it was a different kind of empire. Our empire said this: we have 1,000 ships. You can trade anywhere in the world as long as you don't mess with us. It's okay. Go ahead and go forth and trade. So then you have to sit down and think, okay, the previous empire era, when we called the age of empires, the German, the British, Spanish, and the French empire, they all had one thing in common. They all had deep water fleets, because when you sent out your trading ships, you had to send out your fleets with your ships, okay? Now, under the American empire, we said, hey, you don't have to build that deep water fleet. And the fact is, very few deep water ships actually even exist outside of America. Some in Japan, some in England and China just launched 2 days ago their first aircraft carrier that they let outside of port, okay? So deep water fleets are highly expensive, high technology and so forth. No one could do that. And so think about China. Under our umbrella, they were able to trade across the world with anybody they wanted to, and they didn't have to protect their ships. We allowed it to happen. And so they became an economic superpower. So if we pull back, now we have 256 ships. 40% are in port most of the time because it's a seawater. We have to redo, people have to have off. So we're not there across the world anymore. And we're starting to see that breakdown. I mean, it always cracks me up. I'm a big historian reader. One of my favorite times to read about were the pirates, right? And I was down in Florida, Caribbean, the whole bit and everything. What happened? We had no pirates for 300-400 years. Guess what we got again? We have piracy going around the world. And the reason being is we're not there anymore. So like one of the things I watch news differently. I watch now how many countries are building littoral ships, okay? Now, let me tell you something. Every country in the world has orders out for littoral ships, and these are your missile craft. That's shallow water, not deep water, right? So they can protect their coast with missile ships, okay? They take 10 to 12 years to build, but like the Philippines, Indonesia, Singapore, Japan, everybody's ordering littoral ships because guess what? America ships are not going to be there like they were in the past. So now when you look at a country and the trade may not be easy, we're still going to trade. I'm not saying it's going to go away. Globalization will never go away, but it's going to be different. So what we have to figure out is what is the difference? Okay. So when I look at it, I say, okay, so the Russian-Ukrainian war taught me something on the third day. When they cut off that gas, that changed the entire world forever. Because if you listen to what the countries are saying now, from that day forward, everyone talked about securing their energy, not oil. Before it was, who am I going to order my oil from? Where am I going to get it from, right? That's not the point anymore. Everyone's like, no, 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 no. I need to secure my energy. Look at 2 days ago, 27 countries, including the U.S., formed MSP, which is for the rare earth minerals, to And by the way, in their announcement, to secure the rare earth minerals, okay? So we now look at the world through secure, not through can I buy, which was under globalization, okay? And think about what we did with globalization. We said, hey, you want to go build your parts in Indonesia? Go ahead. Cheaper there. Go build them there. Go build them in China. Build them in Vietnam. Doesn't matter. What are we doing today? Everyone's saying, no, we'll spend the money. We'll pay our corporations to build in our own home country because we want to secure. We're building 16 chip factories in America today. 16. Because of the CHIP Act. Think about that. 3 years ago, we were building none. 10 years from now, we'll be the second biggest chip manufacturer in the world. Today, we get our chip from Taiwan, which is 6,000 miles away, which is 60 miles off the coast of China. Think of Cuba as 90 miles. And we're going to, this is where the most important item of the technology era is coming from. Does this make any sense at all?
Yeah, now I get why they would want to build chip companies. What do you make then economically of what's going to transpire? So what we're saying is the big cop of the beat is standing down. He's retiring. He'll watch his own house, but he's not watching the district anymore. So macroeconomically, there's going to be more buccaneering, piracy potentially, and nations are going to have to watch their own stacks and ships and other things. So that's going to add costs to trade, potentially, if there's bad actors in there. But what does that mean for this transition? In terms of what I see with the debt side of things, we had a massive correction in U.S. debt when we had the faster for longer rate hikes. Do you believe or assess that debt markets have turned since the 2020 events, or do you still think there's going to be an appetite for U.S. debt? Because if there's going to be a diminishing appetite for U.S. debt and we're going more compartmentalized, we're bifurcating, all of this process is occurring, then surely we're going to have potentially dollar-based crises and various other debt-based crises. They're going to be alternating, but they're going to be two different ways of letting out air out of a very extended fiat borrowed into existence state. Is that not going to lead to a rather uncomfortable downdraft for the American economy as a whole? I mean, the handover from Britain to America was the most peaceful transition of, currency of the world. And it doesn't seem like it's going to be to the same agreeable level. They weren't fighting on the same side of the wars like they, So what's looking forward, given the information we have now, what's your projections for that potential downdraft on U.S. asset valuations and a lot of things if the debt and the dollar come under attack?
Okay. So a lot of assumptions there, okay, that this will cause the dollar to come under attack. I'm not saying it's going to be easy and it's going to be up and down, but I would argue, or my thoughts are at this time, that I'm starting to look at countries and evaluating them on a new criteria. So the first thing is are you energy independent? Second thing, are you food independent? Third, do you have good demographics? Fourth, are you technologically proficient? And fifth, can you be attacked easily? Okay. So let's take America. Can you attack America easily?
Not so, I would say.
No, you can't. You have to cross oceans, 6,000 miles to attack us, right? It's not happening, okay? Are we technologically proficient? Yes.
You're well-established Silicon Valley, and you're bringing chips back, as you're referring to. So
yes,
that's good.
Do we have good demographics? We have the best demographics of the Western world. Well, for the Western world, you know, our 30, the 40-year-olds have two kids, and those two kids are going to be the major difference, you know, 20 years down the road, okay? Then you say, are we energy independent? We are. Are we food independent? We are.
During Trump's spell, you were, but you have been an importer as well. So you're
right
marginal.
Now, right. We're totally energy independent.
Certainly a lot better position than Japan on demographics and energy, I would have to say, and many others, and Europe.
why don't you take China? Is China energy independent?
Not.
They import 80%. Are they food independent? No. They import 80%. How is their demographics?
It's also quite poor, surprisingly. Many don't know that.
Some people say they're the worst in the world, okay? By far. Okay, not even close, all right? They're technologically proficient? Yes, they are, but they're not on the high end. You look at technology as level 1, 2, 3, China dominates 3, they're getting better in 2, and they're trying to push their way into 1. Where we're good in 1, we're decent, we have good decent in 2, but we leave that to South Korea and Japan, and then in the third one, we don't participate at all. So every
what are those technological levels? Just define those technological levels that you're referring to, 1, 2, and 3. What categories
now, are those? You know, you look at chips. If you look at high-end chips as number 1, okay, when you're talking Taiwan, some Japan, a little bit of South Korea, and then some in the United States. When you look at level 2, which are cars and tractors and everything, you're talking South Korea and you're talking Japan. When you're talking everything else, your toasters, your microphones, your everything else, that's made in China, okay?
Yes, that's the
there are okay. Levels to technology, just like there's levels to manufacturing,
sure.
Okay? High-end manufacturing, you know, piecework is done in China, okay?
Yeah.
Level 2 is done in places like Vietnam and so forth, and level 3 is done in places like Mexico. Mexico now is 1/10 the manufacturing cost of China. That's why every firm in the world is in China, in Mexico, building their plants. Why are they building them in there?
Well, we've seen that in the performance of the peso over the last 3 years, which has been strengthening immensely after a capitulation the other way. And it also gets them around Trump's type custom tariffs as well, because it's a neighbor and all of that. Yeah, that's fascinating. So, but I mean, when we have this discussion, I'm not proposing China as an alternative to have a good time. I'm saying debt, deflation, that's got to come in. There's going to be negative real rates on to inflation. We're going to have stubbornly high inflation. Most people expect a stagflationary environment, low growth. And if that's to happen on these current debt levels, you're going to see most people, certainly the central banks, not wanting to take be buyers of the treasury. And unlike Japan, America relied on international markets to be supportive. So those are withdrawing, and it's coming down to the rather suspect Cayman Islands, Benelux, London and Japan, the sort of axis, World War II axis, as the primary buyers and holders. So my concern...
That is double ours. They're 260, we're 130. And by the way,
they
couldn't have gotten to the 260 without the yen trade, because the yen trade is we, the West, take their dollars and we go buy their JGBs. That's their government bond. If we weren't doing the yen carry trade for the last 23 years, we wouldn't have bought their bonds. They couldn't have gone to 260%.
We are borrowing yen, and we
buy the bonds and borrow out of the bonds. We buy the yen carry trade is you buy a low yielding government bond currency that is stable. So they were negative interest rates. Okay. So you could have gotten your bonds for 20 bips. All right. Then you take it. Your borrowing costs take like 10 bips of the 20 bips. Now you're making 10 bips. The way this was explained to me 20 years ago by a COO of a G-SIB was, Danny, we're just picking up pennies in front of the steamroller. It's free money until we get rolled. Okay? So the yen carry trade is picking up pennies in front of a steamroller. So any move in the yen or in their interest rates make that trade not profitable. Thereby, people then sell their security somewhere, bring it back, buy the yen, that's why the yen goes up, and cover their short okay, and get rid of their JGBs. I would say, you talk about America, I would say I would flip-flop Argentina and Japan. I'll say the next 30 to 50 years, Japan's going to look a lot like Argentina did the last 30 to 50 years, and Argentina is going to look a lot like Japan over the next 30 to 50 years. Because Argentina is hard to attack. They have great demographics. They got good technology. They're 100% food sufficient, and they're 100% energy sufficient. Thereby, you'll buy their currency because it's a good country, where Japan will be on the opposite side. So you have to rethink on how you actually look at countries. We look at countries today on how do they fit into the global trade pattern. Okay, we'll take that away. Put a country out there. Look at the news coming out on Germany every day. It is so bad, okay? Why is it so bad? When the Russians cut off their gas, they immediately started paying 13 to 1 more than we did for gas. Now it's down to 8 to 1. But their industries are dying. BASF is right now, they're closing all their plants in Germany. Where they go? They're going to Louisiana. We have the cheapest gas in the world, and Louisiana has the cheapest gas in America, okay? Look at what just happened with VW. For the first time in 87 years, they had layoffs. Why? They're an integrated exporter. They had BASF. They did
the Germany, yeah, very distressed. I mean, Volkswagen is almost bankruptcy. I mean, all the car makers are trading below cash value. BMW as well, all of them, they across the board.
Because they're not cost-effective anymore because of the gas. That's why, right?
Yeah, the very high energy inputs, which is one of your criteria which you were mentioning, which I agree with. It's quite important. But what going back to how do you get around the debt situation? Because I know you say Japan's more indebted, but you've got actually the U.S. is 700% when you take the unfunded liabilities in. So it's actually,
you know, unfunded liabilities, just people who want to cut social programs. That, you know, listen, we spend about $1.5 trillion a year on defense. If we cut $500 billion out of that budget, we would be fine. It would be okay. It's as simple as that.
With your boomer generation getting older, more welfare, more Medicaid, with just a third of your defense, I don't know. I don't know how you get to 700% if the unfunded liabilities are that big that they can just be sorted by 500 billion. But
500 billion a year. You got to remember something. Under Clinton, we actually went positive on our thing, and Bush then immediately gave the second largest tax cut in history behind Trump, okay? And we immediately went back into huge debt again. But we were actually only 2 years away from having zero debt, okay? So we can do it. But point is...
That's 47. You see, that's the demographics. Peak prosperity, peak taxes paid at 47. Your boomer generation's core mean was 47 years old. Now they pension it.
But we're not going to run the world like we did before. We don't have 1,000 ships. We have 256 ships. We're going to start closing our bases. We're not going to fight every war anymore. No one wants it in our country. All right. No,
Yellen hasn't received that memo from you because she's
very difficult ending empire, right? Empire will try to continue its way right to the end. But I would say, the deglobalization has already started, and I think it's irreversible, in my opinion. It's not going to reverse. And so thereby, over the next 5 to 10 years, as we are challenged on many different issues, we will slowly but surely start saying, hey, do we really need to be over here? Do we need to be here? And the answer, I think, most of the time is going to be no. Okay? It's going to be no.
But I still feel that there's no way you don't escape. Politicians are not going to be doing this reining back, you know, the Little Britain, as they called it, when they had to become empire again. It's very reluctant, and it's usually these things are enforced upon you politically, and not things that are voluntarily done.
And it'll be But look at what's going on this week. You saw Starmer's series of speeches on we have to get our house in order. Times are going to get tough before it gets better, right? You just saw France, their new finance minister, come out and say, we have a huge debt problem. We're really under the gun, okay? And we have to raise taxes. You have Germany saying the same thing because now their output, their exports are just dying, okay? Fact is, for the first time in history, yesterday, Spanish yields were lower than the French yields on government bonds for the first time in history, okay? I would say, I look at Europe and say, the euro, I don't think it's going to survive. I think you're going to see like Denmark, Netherlands, and Germany form a coalition, and then Central Europe under France form another coalition. It won't be euro the way we see it today, because the old way, Germany was the dominant factor because they were the dominant economic power. And they paid for everything. So when we guaranteed this Greek bonds, we considered it a guarantee because the Germans said, okay, we can guarantee it. The Germans aren't going to guarantee anymore. They're hurting badly. So they're going to start pulling back.
This is failed socialism, really. All of them, Germany, France, this is, we tried socialism and failed. But what they're actually going to say is we tried capitalism and it's failed. But in actual fact, it's the welfare state. It's the immigration policies. It's the overexpenditure that comes from expanding government, which is actually socialism. It's not libertarian light, government light. But I don't think they're going to take the pill. That is the real lesson. They're going to make other forms of assumptions and saying lack of government power and we need to have more control. I think we're stumbling into totalitarianism in terms of the narrative. Don't forget, anybody who questions it and is against expansion of government is a far right, anti-Semite, racist immigrant, even though they haven't made a comment on immigration policy, just asking for smaller government. So I think we're going to have to go, that this is not, I agree, I'm asking the question on America, do they not have this downdraft? That doesn't mean I don't see this as being a global event with all these other malpractices. Nations of UK and the Western Europe too. I just think it's more significant if it's America and how it goes for a global downturn that could be incredibly destabilizing. And my concern is, will there be a conflict to create heat? And we seem to be very well set up for that, because if things escalate with Russia, China will grab Taiwan while everyone's distracted, and various other things could go down in a game theory sense. And if people are saying there's a lot of liquidity, I wanted to bring this chart in. This is change of tack. I'll give you an opportunity to respond to those comments as well. But I did want to bring in this liquidity chart that I mentioned with you. Excuse me while I just dig it up. And it was it's a popular theory that we're about to get a major move up in global liquidity. And I'm not sure that we have the justification for that, because the mood is very much one concern around inflation. And this is from Raoul Powell and the Real Vision guys. And they highlighted periods where the liquidity wasn't expanding particularly, and then how it subsequently really is revved up. But this is the Bitcoin chart, and you've started sharing some of your takes, and you're welcome to bring that in as well in your answer. But where are we on liquidity? Do you see a burst to the upside, or are you first seeing a mini crisis? Because this relatively small period here was actually a major contraction just before we got it. Do we need event risk before to wipe away this inflation fear, which is another reason why I think oil's going down, before we get the liquidity super surge that will drive risk assets again? What's your take on how do things go down? Do we go down first to go up, or are we just going to go into a liquidity expansion from here, in your take?
All right. I don't have one take. I have a video out there on narratives on how I look at the world. I have multiple narratives. I only watch the news to see if a news item, a data point, supports a narrative or not. I don't make up a narrative and then try to have the news support what I believe, okay? because that's being prejudiced and thereby you miss the big picture. Okay? So we don't want to do that. So the liquidity that's in the market today coming in from the expansion of the balance sheet and then from all the government spending, it's here. There's nothing we can do about it. Now, the question you're saying is, and I, one of my narratives I've had since 2008 after I read the Panic of 1907 was, is that there is this, there is a narrative, a possible narrative that we could go to 2029, just like we went to 1929 before we come down. Because if you read the Panic of 1907 and then follow it through to 1929, it kind of like, we're kind of like singing the same song with the same beat all the way along. Do we make it to 2029? I have no idea. It's still a narrative out there. I haven't been able to take it off the board. The biggest thing, though, is that I'm looking more, this transition is happening no matter what happens. But, you know, the English just decided, the BOE literally came out with a statement and said, we are not going to cut our interest rates at this time, even though economically it seems like the thing to do. The reason being is because we want to be able to raise our debt. So in other words, they're afraid that if they go out to the market, then the market will put a premium driving up their interest rates, whether they like it or not, so they can issue their debt. The French bonds, I mean, you could build a narrative now saying that all the countries are in bad need of money. And I believe that one of the things that's going to happen, whether you like it or not, is that there's going to be major, major tax reform against all the rich in the world. I mean, you know, less than 1% on 50% of the assets. It's, you know, we superseded 1929 and in 2009. So I would say taxation is on its way, or your tax havens, I think, are going to kind of get crushed here for the next 20, 30 years. Because the governments need the money and they can't issue the debt any longer. And you're seeing that with the BOE, and you're seeing that with, and look at what Japan, I mean, China. How would you read China today? Would you say sell the yuan because obviously their economy is going down? Or would you say, look at the stimulus they're throwing in, so we should buy the yuan? What's the answer? That's the question you should be asking.
They're putting in stimulus. I don't think that's good for the yuan per se, but I think it'll be good for their risk assets. I think their stock market might improve, and that liquidity will drive asset upside valuations. They probably also need to put a floor under their overdeveloped property market that since 2016, when we had the Shanghai Accord, that's been a big hangover for an extended period. So I think that liquidity will shore up the weak property market and pump up their stock market. At least they've let their stock market fall to a degree. And my concern is in the American stock market keeps hitting new highs. Well, the MAG 7, we need to be specific because some parts of the stock market actually represent good value, and particularly gold mines, which I'm a big fan of right now. But even S&P 500's equities, some of them are okay.
Our stock market is now like, what, 70, 80% of all the stock markets, and we're only 23% of production. So I think we're a little overvalued, okay?
Yeah.
And by the way, I'm talking about the Chinese stock market. I don't care. What I care about is the yuan, because Chinese exporters hold $1 trillion worth of U.S. dollars. And the dollar has been very stable for them, and the yuan has gone down. Well, the yuan yesterday, for the first time in 3 years, went above 7 on the yuan, okay? So if there's perception now that the yuan is going to move up while the dollar is moving down because we're cutting interest rates, do you see the Chinese exporters selling their U.S. dollars, bringing back to and buying the yuan because they want to capture that move? So we could be faced with a double thing. We could have the yen carry trade. And by the way, the Japanese and China, they're their two largest trading partners, not the U.S. They trade about $355 billion worth of goods every year. So if the yuan starts taking off, then the Japanese yen is going to come as pressure. And what are they going to do? How is he going to raise his interest rates, which he said yesterday he wants to raise the interest rate, when that would send the yen up and make it less competitive against the yuan when they're exporting huge amounts to China. So the currencies are in play everywhere. And when currencies are in play, in my personal opinion, I have no facts back this, people run to our only quasi currency play in the world, which is gold and silver.
Yeah.
It's not a currency. It'll never be either currency. But psychologically, it's a quasi currency in the people's minds in the world.
Yeah. I agree. And so like us, I assume you think there's still plenty further upside on the precious metals to come.
Right. Well, if it goes to the bottom of your chart there.
This is the dollar Chinese one.
So if you're a Chinese exporter, and the Chinese are pressuring their exporters to bring their dollars home, okay? Because guess what? China needs the money. So they pressure them, and now it looks like the yuan is going to go down to that. What are you down there? 670 around there, right?
672 is round about here, the lows.
Okay, so what would you do if you're a Chinese exporter? You sell your dollars and buy the yuan, make your government happy and make some money at the same time? It's not the Chinese government. It's the exporters.
Yeah.
They're business people. Will they make a business decision? I think they will.
Yeah. But that's a sale. That's downward pressure. That'll add to the downward pressure on the dollar, and to the strength on the yuan. And of course, we've had the yen get a bunch stronger as well. So that's these two currencies, that the Eastern currencies are actually in a point of going up. That's why I say it feels to me like a dollar devaluation period, because you had the debt take a hammering with the rate spikes. Now you're putting a bid under it. And what you were describing for Britain, the concern that there would be no one for their debt, you're already past two cuts, essentially, in 225s, 50 basis points. Where do you allow the deflation of this thing? You've got to let the currency go then, if you still expect a bid. The two sides of the seesaw, I've got to have a spell going down. After the debt market went 45% down, the long-term debt. So I feel the dollar currency is in for a difficult spell. And that's going to lead to imported inflation to America, which is why I see possibly the consumer commodity, that is oil, looking weak. Because one of the biggest consumer nations are potentially going to be importing inflation. Things are going to get more expensive. This is why, as I say, I'm pointing to a tough time for the consumer in America, short and medium term, in this environment. Well, what would you say?
Historically, comes in waves, usually about three and a half. It goes one higher and higher. So I have a video on my video file there. It's at least a year and a half old, if not 2 years old. And I said, this is only the first wave. We're probably going to end up somewhere between 13 and 15% inflation in the third wave. The second wave being around 8 to 10. And finally, then we'll go down. The fourth wave will be back to like 5 to 7, and then we'll be back down again. But the inflation normally comes in waves. So I'm assuming that we're just are finishing off the first wave. And from here, I expect we're going to see inflation moving up, in my opinion, but it's only my opinion. I just think I don't see.
Well, 9% in the first wave. It smells like double digits in the second wave, or more than feasible.
I would say there are two things there. I mean, one, I think the money that we threw into the market, the massive amount of liquidity around the world, we were not the only ones doing QE. Every government did QE, okay? And so thereby, I think that caused, let's say, the base inflation case. Then when we had our first deglobalization, which we now refer to as the supply chain of being redone, okay, that added another 2 to 3% inflation on top of the inflation that we were experiencing from the massive amount of money that the governments have thrown into the markets. Okay. Now, we're starting to do QT. We're down $2 trillion, but we're still up. Plus, people don't realize that, you know, the U.S. government this past year had to raise $9 trillion. They did it in a short end of the market. It's called ATI. And ATI, they now figure, has thrown $1 trillion worth of liquidity into the market. And ATI is this: 84% of all the bonds that the U.S. government issued this year were less than 2 years in duration. Okay?
Short term, yeah.
Right? All short term. 84%. Okay? And so someone said to me, well, why don't they just cut the interest rates? Then it'll be cheaper to raise the debt. And I said, well, why don't they just issue the 10-year, which is 2 points cheaper than the short-term debt? Right.
Well, there was a concern for the bid, much what you said about Britain. They had a couple of events where they were very poorly covered on the longer-term side.
Liz Truss put in an $88 billion tax cut for the rich and said that she's going to find another $80 billion to give to the poor people as soon as she could figure it out. Okay. Well, everyone said, okay, we're selling down the pound and we're selling down your bonds. And it was so bad that they literally had to fire Liz Truss and reverse the entire position, or they wouldn't be able to raise any money through their bond, through government bonds. And so there was an indication of what all the countries are going to face because we all did QE, every one of us.
Yeah. And I think that's what Yellen was reacting to. She was avoiding the Truss era by issuing short term because people said there's not the appetite for your long term at that rate. And this is the problem, I think, because we're seeing people realize that debt bull market is over. It's going to be in the negative real interest rates generally. And it's the one asset class almost no one should have. And by virtue of European and British pensions a lot, especially if you leave it managed by other people, it's the one thing you're assured you have plenty of because the pension funds have been gorging on it. 401ks in the States, I think you have the power to just put equities and not be bullied into bonds. But so Europe, there's a pension crisis coming, surely, across the board.
There's a lot going on out there, but I, you know, for the most part, we can work our way through things. I would say that people need to, if I would have any suggestion to give the people, I would start looking at the global logistics as a way of understanding what is going to happen in the world. I mean, you said China taking Taiwan. I think there's about -500% chance they'll even attempt to do that. The reason being is the Malacca Strait. You know where that is? 80%.
It's one with Malaysia, where you've got to go through the
80% of their energy and their food go through the Malacca Strait. We could put one submarine at the end of the Malacca Strait, which is 19 miles wide, and China would have no energy and no food in a month. Zero. Now, I didn't say this. Now, I read a lot about China, and back in 1971, Deng Xiaoping, remember him, the little guy who took over from Mao? He made a very famous speech. He said, China will never be a world power until we solve the Malacca Strait dilemma.
Yeah. Now, I've read about this in energy markets. It is there. I think it's the driver behind reestablishing the Belt and Road and all these pipelines that are going on. They've got to get around that bottleneck. It's almost like a tourist canal for them.
I know it helps, but let's be honest, okay? Pipelines and rail are extremely poor substitute for ships. It's not even in the ballgame, okay? Yeah. Right? So I would say one of the great in the future, in the new world, that India is going to be a important person because everything that leaves the Middle East has to go right by India. So I think you could see a toll system. Right? Yeah, you're going to have oil, but we're going to pay a toll. Look at what's going on with the Houthis right now in China. The China oil ships go through the Red Sea because they're paying the Houthis a fee for every ship that goes through. Mm. Okay?
Well, the way of Marco Polo, the mercantilist gangland extractors, you crossed their deserts and you paid or you got ransomed. So I think it's...
And that's what... So all these things are breaking down because we're pulling back. We are pulling back, which I would approve of, by the way. All right. I don't think we should sit astride the world and make all these or spend all that money. And we're not going to in the future. So I would say lots of local wars, because when the big boys pull back, then the little boys will fight among themselves. Okay. So I think that will be a characteristic of the new world, will be lots of little wars as people fight it out. But the big guys are all China. You see their numbers. They're hurting. You believe we're hurting. Europe is hurting. We've been the big boys for the last 70 years. All of us together.
Yeah.
So how is that going to work?
Well, a global contraction on a debt, they all followed the same. I refer to the world, the big economic powers, as the leper colony. They all kissed the chief leper, and they all pursued expansionary monetary policy. And they've all been synchronized into a simultaneous debt collapse, because there's also a lot of inter-cross holdings. And it is a bit of ring-a-ring-a roses. And so I don't think, I'm not putting forward anyone getting out of this very well. There's just degree.
The way I put it is, I believe the transition will be challenging. You can't say it's going to be bad. You can't say it's going to, people get all upset. It's going to be challenging. And by the way, though, if you look at it and take a step back and say, in the end, where do I want to be? What do I want to own? I would want to own Canada, the United States, and Mexico, because those three together are a manufacturing powerhouse, technology powerhouse, demographic powerhouse, food and energy powerhouse, and you can't attack them.
I like that in theory. I just don't like the trajectory of the three leaders in terms of the where they're going. You want to be a citizen in those countries? I would actually say no.
No,
I wouldn't. In fact, Mexico may be the most, but it's also got a new leader that's BlackRock approved. So maybe from a point of view, economic resources, your three rules, but not in terms of the political freedom. It's almost like the capitalist nations have now got to go do communism, cultural Marxism, and actually the ex-Marxist nations might actually end up being more capitalist. It's this whole thesis, antithesis, synthesis that's been played on us, that you might actually want to be in an ex-communist nation. But what do I know?
I think about it this way. I mean, in the last era, 46 to 2019, basically, the nations, most of them, not the status, most of them had a laissez-faire. They said, look, we'll take care of the money supply, we'll do the taxes and everything, but you guys decide where you're going to go. And the corporations decided, we're going to go where I can build the product the cheapest way. Okay? Yeah. And they did. So now I believe the corporations always acted in their own best interests, which doesn't necessarily mean in the best interests of their domicile country. And I believe that the CHIPS Act was the first act where we sat there and said, whoa, 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 guys, if you're going to build a factory, you're going to build it here, even if we have to pay for it. Okay? And so for the first time in history, we're telling a corporation, no, stop. You can't do this anymore. Look at what Draghi just introduced into Europe, basically an $850 billion CHIPS Act, okay? Yeah. Now, people don't realize this. The day after we passed the CHIPS Act, Macron flew to Washington and met with Biden and said, you can't do this. And Biden told him, hey, we're not buying our chips off this island 60 miles off the coast of China. We're ending that, and I don't care what you guys say. Macron flies back. Van der Leyen the next day comes out and says, people, we need to pass a CHIPS Act for Europe. It went nowhere until Draghi came in, and now Draghi's like, listen, and if you actually read through Draghi's document, it actually makes a lot of sense. But it actually is calling almost for a united Europe, and that is a leap that they have to make on their own. Can they or not? I have no idea. My thing is, I think they bifurcate. That's what I think.
Yeah. Yeah, they're too divided. I'm, you know, just with reference to taxation, corporate tax in Russia is far cheaper. Personal taxes are far lower than the three nations you mentioned. And I feel that America's going in the wrong direction with that because of the debt. In other words, they're going to be forced, even if they're not prone to becoming socialist or being Marxist or taxing to the nth degree, just the force of the situation will see them make all the wrong decisions before the right ones get going. And there's that whole cycle of Argentina into eventually doing a Milei, which might resurrect Argentina. The trajectory and the trend might change after trying all the wrong things first, you know? So yeah, that's that. What would your trades be? How would you position someone? So let's put you as IFA for the moment. It's not what you are. It's not advisory. It's an opinion. But outside of where you live, what assets would you choose to hold right now? How would you construct a basic portfolio? What is the Dan Gallagher's portfolio of the moment for reset times, which is a challenging one?
I would look at energy and food. I would be an owner of both. And
I like that.
I can see a narrative. I have multiple. I don't have one narrative. I have multiple upon multiple narratives. Like I have multiple narratives for Europe. I have multiple. Okay. So I could see a day if the energy is disrupted across the world. So look at what's going on with Russia and the Ukraine. Okay. They do all the food. So far, Russia has allowed Ukraine to ship all their wheat down to Africa because guess what? Most of Africa gets fed from the Ukraine. If the Ukraine is cut off, Africa starves, right? So who's all the client states for Russia? Africa. So they're letting all that food go because if they didn't, all the African nations would throw them out, all right? Yeah. So if we have a disruption in energy in the world, which I believe we are about to have, I could see a scenario where in America that we cap a barrel of oil at $150 a barrel and allow no exports at all, right?
To take and maybe limit consumption. Consumption limits as well.
You know that we have enough. I mean, we're doing 14 million barrels a day. Saudi Arabia is doing 9. Okay, we use 13. The thing is the mix. We said we're now doing LNG all over the world. We're the biggest exporter of LNG. And by the way, we're opening up 10 LNG ports in the next 3 years. Okay, so we are going to be a big player in energy. But for the rest of the world, here's the question. We have 182 countries. How many of those countries are energy sufficient? How many of those countries export energy? Okay, and all the rest are in trouble, okay? Look at Serbia. After the Russian cut off the gas, Serbia had an emergency session 2 years ago, and they said by 2030, we want 60% of all our energy to be alternative energy. And they literally said, we don't care, tidal, solar, anything, okay, but oil and gas, all right? And now Serbia is not exactly a most progressive nation on earth. What they want is to secure their energy. So where China for 10 years put down more solar panels than the rest of the world added up, last year China put down 300% more than they did in the prior 10 years. Why? Because they saw what happened to Germany. And no one wants that to happen. So will China take Taiwan someday? Yes, they will. But until you can solve the Malacca Strait dilemma, it won't matter. They're not going to take it. They're not going to take that chance. I wouldn't.
Yeah, makes sense. And gold? I'm assuming you would include that as something new.
I don't want to be known as a gold bug, I believe, right? And if you talk to my family, they own a lot of silver dollars. But I believe gold has this quasi currency status in the minds of men across the world. And because it's quasi, it's not an equivalent. We'll never use it. We learned that in 1907. 1907 almost literally crashed the whole country because we were on gold certificates, okay? And it almost killed us. So that'll never happen again because gold is not flexible enough, all right? But it still has that quasi-currency status. And so I've noticed in my 50 years in the business, gold does not go crazy on inflation, that no one cares. It goes crazy when the currencies go crazy. And right,
just devaluation crazy as well.
So people say, I'll sit to the sideline in a quasi-currency until I see where the currencies are going, and then I'll go back. Okay? So is everyone going to do that? No. Are some people going to crypto? Of course. Okay? You can't believe on my comments how people think that the BRICS is the answer, which to me is laughable, but hey, that they actually believe BRICS are the answer. It's no way. Never happening.
Yeah, I would say portfolioed. There's a bigger resource companies, countries. If you put them as a collective, that doesn't mean they're well run. It doesn't mean they're well organized. India's chaos. China had so many problems. South Africa is crazy town. Brazil. But I think you've got soft commodities. You've got energies. You've got tech. You've got as a collective, you've got that. You've got an immense amount of population and a growing population, probably with, thanks to Brazil. Russia's got very pro-birth policies. I wouldn't say, but I just don't think they're going to be that organized. Like your European comment, they're fragmented. And I don't know if they can get more tightly bound than the Europeans could, but I doubt it. Because they're very disparate.
I doubt
it.
Look at Brazil and Argentina. They're not friends. If you know their history, they don't like each other.
Yeah.
Okay. Yet, they formed a year and a half ago a barter system on X amount of products. They said, okay, Argentina, if you send us your beef, we will send you corn, okay, and we'll agree on what the exchange rate is. So in other words, what are the countries trying to solve for? You own the Argentina peso. If you want to buy something from Brazil, you have to change it into the dollar, then change it into the Brazil real, buy your product, and then ship it back home. Those two transitions are friction that cost the countries money. They don't like that. Okay? Yeah. You know, Argentina and Brazil said, look it, we know we're going to buy your corn. You know you're going to buy our beef. So why don't we just barter at a fixed exchange rate that we decide on every year? Okay?
Yeah.
So they're bartering. You're going to see a lot more bartering, especially from the South, because you're right. What do they own? They own commodities, right?
Yeah.
You're going to barter those commodities for things in the future. They're not going to use...
It'll be like a futures contract. Instead of priced in dollars, priced in another's futures contract. Standard lot size of weight, quality, etc. I can see that, and that would be... That's smart. And that points to a lot of bilaterals between neighbors agreeing and getting things done. And I think as that catches on, that's going to be great.
The end of globalization means more bilateral deals with the smaller players. They don't have
to offer. Yeah,
right,
as well.
They don't have to plug in to the global world to get their stuff. They're going to go, okay, now we'll negotiate one-on-one and we'll barter with these people. Okay.
Yeah. And they don't pay the transactional taxes of the dollar, getting into the dollar and out of it and having to deal with banks, US banks possibly as well, and all of that. I can see that, and I can see it going on. The interesting thing is the more I see it for nations, the more I see them not wanting that for their citizens on account of the tax extracting aspect. And it's the thing we should most want, to barter with our local farmer for our service and his goods. But that's not going to be universally popular for...
You want a scary stat? Here's what's... all the stats I know, this one scared me the most. 100 years ago, the average piece of food on your dinner table at night came from within 10 miles of your house. Today, it's 1,000 miles.
Yeah.
So I
and,
would...
And that's, all, that's the contamination as well. I wouldn't say it's better product because the minute you're traveling...
I talked to my brother and he said, so what's the number one thing we should do? And I said,
we
need to shorten the distance between our food table and our food source. I said, I don't care how you do it, how you think about it. You have to shorten that thing because if
I like that,
if we believe globalization is coming, is changing, we're transitioning into a new world. The three biggest things in globalization: food, energy, and currencies.
Yeah.
Right? And if they get disruptive, one of them, just one, there's going to be massive problems everywhere. Okay? So watch your food, watch your energy, right? Get yourself the battery for your home, right? And cut your utility bill by 80% the first day, okay? And then, you know, I don't know where you're at, but, you know, I moved to upstate New York near Saratoga Springs for a reason, okay? And by the way, where's the number one spot that people now say to go buy and live in the United States?
I wouldn't know. You tell me.
Upstate New York. Why? Because they're building all the chip factories on the Great Lakes, because what do you need more than energy when you build a chip?
Energy?
You need water.
Hydropower.
Okay? And by the way, look what's happened in the Taiwan Semiconductor down in Arizona. Their chip factory is coming online, and they're already in a death struggle with all the cities down there because they're using up all the water for their chips. Why Taiwan built it in Arizona is like the greatest mystery in the world to me. You need water, for God's sakes.
Yeah, fascinating. Dan, it's been a great chat. Thank you for your time. How do people engage and find you for your opinions and takes? We call them scenarios. You call them...
Narratives.
Yes.
Narratives.
Narratives. Okay, good. Stories. To find out more about all your various narratives on the direction of the world, how should they find you?
I'm on TikTok, on at All Things Financial Zero. Someone else has All Things Financial. I'm on YouTube on, let me tell you, it's All Things Financial 74065. So that's...
74065. We'll put that...
And then I'm on Twitter, X... under All Things Financial.
Great. But excellent. I really enjoy it.
If they go to TikTok, they can find where I'm in because I've just started this. So I was only on TikTok for about a year and a half, 2 years. And I've just expanded out because of people asking me to go to YouTube and then go to, and you're my second podcast. Okay. So I did one with Lead Lag, right? And that was first one. So, this is all new to me. I'm trying to figure it out, what to do and what to say, what people want to hear about. So mostly what I do is logistics. And if anyone wants to read a book, I think today that Peter Zeihan, The End of the World or whatever it is Here Now or something like that, Zeihan. I don't own it. Don't get any money from it. But Peter Zeihan is from Stratford. And if you know anything about Stratford, there are military logistics. I mean, I think it costs $15,000 a year to get their letter, right? So I don't get it, obviously. But he left Stratford. He's a logistics expert, global logistics expert. So if you want to understand the logistics of the world so that you can make financial decisions, this is a great base case. By the way, Peter doesn't talk about climate change. He doesn't talk about deglobalization. He's only logistics. So if you want to know where your oil comes from, how it gets here, who refines it, who does this, who does what, this guy writes down everything for you. So to me, you start at the logistics and work your way up. That's how I do it. I'm logistics.
Yeah, that's very much the supply chain world we're in. Excellent. Thank you again for your time, and we'll put that book recommendation in there as well. I'm looking forward to reading it, and I think I'll take you up on that one. Thanks for your time, Dan. All the best, and have a great weekend ahead.
Thank you, Francis, for having me. I appreciate it.
Tired of profit wipeouts and blown accounts from following trade signal groups and other YouTube channels?
Yeah, thank you.
Looking for a better way to trade, reduce your stress, and minimize your risk? Become a skilled technical analyst and see the charts and markets in a new light using the successfully proven HVF method by Francis Hunt, while being surrounded and supported by a principled, structured, and experienced community. Enjoy a constructive learning environment while practically trading markets, supported by a bespoke platform run through browser and app, specifically designed to teach and engage you whilst learning and growing as the markets move. This is not a Telegram or Slack signal group. All trade ideas are based on a proprietary technical analysis process honed over decades, which is the HVF method, leading to trade ideas with fast-moving breakouts and tight stops, exact entries and exits, nuanced interim considerations, and ultimately, strong rewards. Submissions are graded and scored by Francis for potential high-quality setups, and we provide bespoke tools to help get the job done properly and with precision. Over time and with focused effort, you'll begin to look at charts and price action just like Francis. Community updates every day by Francis and our three webinars a week provide a 360-degree approach, which are presented by our experienced team of trade leaders to spot potential trades. We're a community of self-actualized individuals, spanning the globe and active 24/7, 365. The premium community provides a warm, supportive, and cooperative place for people willing to listen, participate, contribute, and to learn. We've changed thousands of traders' lives. Transform your approach to trading now. Transform your life. Book an introductory call with us on the link below.